UK-based political activist, historian, writer Tariq Ali is back in New Zealand delivering a series of lectures, the subjects of which cover just some of his areas of interest: Islam and its discontents, US power today, and the rise of China. He is the Sir Douglas Robb Lecturer at the University of Auckland, 2011. Born in Lahore, he went to Oxford University. He was elected president of the Oxford Union Debating Club and became a revolutionary socialist, a time described in just one of his many books, Street Fighting Years, an autobiography of the 60s. Indeed, it is said that Mick Jagger wrote the song Street Fighting Man for Tariq Ali back in the day. He joins me now in an Auckland studio. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Can we just attend to that frivolity before we look at global upheaval? Did Mick Jagger write that song for you?
Well, he sent it to me with a note at the time saying, I've written this song for you, and the BBC are refusing to play it, so could you publish it in your newspaper, please?
And your newspaper at the time was?
The Black Dwarf. It was an underground political cultural fortnightly, when we could manage to bring it out every fortnight. And so we put the song in his own handwriting in the newspaper, and on the cover we put Mick Jagger and Frederick Engels on street fighting.
Have you still got the original?
You know, I threw it away.
Oh, what?
Yeah, we didn't go in for this sort of stuff in those days.
Oh, Kate. Individual stuff.
Yeah, individual stuff. It was all chucked away. No encouragement of celebrity, celebrity style, celebrity politics. Many a letter from John Lennon went in the same waste bin. So, you know, of course, now one regrets it a bit, but that's what we were like.
It's a long time ago. I mean, I only know that story because I read it in Christopher Hitchens' memoir.
Right.
And how is he now?
I have no idea.
Are you no longer in touch with him at all?
I have not been in touch with him ever since he became a Bush groupie, supported the war on Iraq, encouraged people to go and die there, and still refuses to regret that episode.
And old friendship does not overcome political difference?
He was never a friend. He was someone I used to see.
He calls you a friend, Tariq.
I think he does, and he's wrong. We were never close friends at all. He was a friendly acquaintance.
Let us look at what is happening in North Africa and the Middle East, Tunisia and Egypt and Bahrain and Yemen, the winds of change. The winds of change seem to have stopped blowing in Libya, of course. What do you think?
Well, I think that the changes taking place in the Middle East are epochal. I compare them to the uprisings in Europe in 1848, which transformed Europe, even though victories weren't won in every single case. And I think the fact that the people, the citizens, ordinary people in the Arab world are coming out and saying, we want democracy, we want new constitutions, we want to change the way in which we've been living and being forced to live for the last 30 to 40 years, ruled by despots backed by the West, is something which is going to transform that region. A great deal will depend on what happens in Egypt, where one battle has been won, but the war is by no means over.
I mean, are we talking about revolutionary socialism? We're talking about reform.
We're not talking about revolutionary socialism, Kim. Very few people do that. Essentially, what we're talking about is radical democracy, constitutions which offer people political freedoms and social rights that this world has forgotten, such as the right to a free education, to health, to shelter. These are rights which are very strongly being demanded by people all over the Arab world. The Tunisians started it off. The Egyptians are carrying on. It's spreading all over. People were killed in the Yemen yesterday, which I visited last year. And so it's just a revolt for political and social freedom.
It's very hard to get a handle on things because there's a lot of information, disinformation, misinformation around. I mean, for example, you've written of Yemen, having been there, that the risks of Al-Qaeda using it as a base have been exaggerated.
Mm-hmm.
How do we know that? How do you know that?
I know that because I travelled the country. I went to the south of Yemen, which was meant to be an Al-Qaeda base, and I spoke to people in the town of Shibam, where they were meant to be, and asked them. I said, you know, is there a strong Al-Qaeda presence? And an old Yemeni came up to me and said, should I tell you where Al-Qaeda is stationed? I said, do. And he whispered in my ear, they must be in an office very close to the president, because whenever they are needed, they appear. And this was the general view, including from the former Prime Minister, Iriani, in the country. And I asked him, I said, how many Al-Qaeda members do you think there are? And he looked at me and smiled. I said, come on, should I have a guess? 200? And he said, at the most. In other words, a lot of these despotic regimes have exaggerated the threat to get more money, more weaponry from the West. The Yemeni dictator, Saleh, is one of them. Gaddafi has been another. I mean, when the uprising began in Libya, his first instinct was to appeal to the West and say, this is an Al-Qaeda uprising against me. So they have used this because they know that the West is vulnerable on this front and usually backs them up. But of course, the Al-Qaeda threat is most intelligence agencies of the Western world, including US agencies now, say is minimal.
So if you were Al-Qaeda, where would you go?
Well, I don't know, because the areas are limited. I mean, what exists of them largely is in Afghanistan and Pakistan. I mean, that's where they exist. That's where the Afghan war is being fought. And the more people that die in Afghanistan, I mean Afghans, the more people join the resistance in that country against the NATO occupation.
So what should be done about Afghanistan, which you've described as Hamid Karzai's squalid narco state? And that's hard to argue with.
Well, I think the West has to find an exit strategy and get out as soon as possible.
But what's the exit strategy? I mean, you're going to be leaving a mess whatever way you go.
I think this is now, it's reached that stage, Kim, and I think you're right on that. It is going to be a mess. One can't pretend otherwise. But I think they missed their chance. Three or four years ago, I argued that an effective exit strategy would be to involve the neighboring countries, not Pakistan alone, but also Iran, Russia, and China, in guaranteeing a national government, and China in guaranteeing rebuilding the country with massive social and economic aid.
Well, hell would freeze over, wouldn't it? You know, for anybody to countenance Iran being involved up front at all.
Exactly. But, you know, there's a very interesting new book out by a senior British diplomat who was ambassador to Moscow, Roderick Braithwaite, who's written an account of the Russian invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, which, as you will recall, was opposed by every single Western country, which then backed the jihad and created part of the mess. I mean, the Russians did, and so did the West. And Braithwaite describes what the Russians did, and every single page of the book could be repeated today, except with Russia replaced by America and its allies. It's a total and complete mess. There is no way they can win the war in Afghanistan, and it's utterly pathetic for the vassal states of the United States to get involved in this war too. I think they should start pulling out soon.
Vassal states, you mean?
By vassal states, I mean Britain, France, New Zealand, Australia, let's add them. They are mini vassal states here, but they are.
Not only have you described New Zealand as a vassal state of the United States, you've also described New Zealand as a loyal satrap.
Both apply, Kim. Both apply. I mean, whichever they
That's
prefer.
That's not what New Zealand would like to think of itself as. What is your evidence?
My evidence is that whenever the Americans need New Zealand...
Hello, did we go to Iraq? We did not.
No, you didn't go to Iraq, nor did the Germans and the French, but all of you were in Afghanistan. And I think that is, you know, what the New Zealanders and the Aussies tend to do, you know, fall on their knees whenever the master beckons and do his bidding.
Well, hang on. What makes you think we're on our knees doing the bidding of the United States? What makes you think that we are not making up our own minds, that it would be a good idea, right or wrong, to go into Afghanistan, to help in Afghanistan. We have a reconstruction force in Afghanistan.
Yeah, yeah, that's the word that is often used. You know, your people have died there. They're backing a NATO effort. And of course you make up your own minds, but the decision is essentially taken in Washington. Would you be there if the Americans hadn't decided to go in? Of course you wouldn't be. And tiny states like New Zealand or Denmark, which say we're there to do good, so, you know, the question is, will you still be doing good when the Americans instruct you to withdraw? Of course you won't. I mean, America is the dominant power in the region, and I'm afraid both Australia and New Zealand have followed that power just as they used to follow the British Empire during its heyday. There's no very little independence in these regions. They refuse to accept the geography in which they are located and still dream of being part of the great Western empires.
We'll get back to the Arab world in a moment because it's fascinating right now. But I just, one of the lectures that you're delivering is called The Rise of China. Mm-hmm. Now, if China becomes as powerful in a global sense as the United States, and it is heading that way, will you be as critical? In other words, would your lecture, US Power Today, The Global Hegemon, be as likely to be titled in how many years' time, Chinese Power Today, The Global Hegemon?
Certainly, if they became a carbon copy of the United States.
Well, power is power, is it not?
No, it isn't. I mean, there's economic power, there is political power, and there is military power. And the Chinese at the moment are not popular ideologically in most parts of the world. They are very much in demand economically because they're now the workshop of the world. Their goods go to every market in the world. And they've transformed themselves on that front. Militarily, they are way behind the United States. I mean, the United States military budget is more than the next 8 countries put together after it. So there is absolutely no way in which the Chinese could even dream of playing that role, even if they wished to.
Is that just a question of time?
I don't think so. I think that the world is changing. I think the United States could well turn out to be the last of the old empires. The European empires collapsed in the 20th century, and I think the United States is stagnating. It's stagnating economically, it's stagnating politically, and it's making up for its lack of economic muscle militarily. And this can't go on forever. So not that I'm saying predicting an imminent collapse of the U.S. empire, but I am saying that it is going to be the last of its kind. No one can repeat that. What we are more likely to see is regional powers, regional conglomerations, and of course, China is not alone in Asia. You know, you have India, you have a huge continent, the Far Eastern sector on its own, of course, could be very strong indeed. And the big question is, will Korea unite? Will Japan get nuclear weapons? It seems awful to think about that at the moment, but it's been considered.
Possibly not after this, do you think?
I hope not, Kim, but people never learn, you know. It was rash, I think, of the Japanese government to go in so big on nuclear reactors, given that the country is prone to earthquakes.
To be fair to the Japanese, it wasn't the earthquake that did for the nuclear reactors, it was a tsunami.
Well, the tsunami is an underground earthquake under the water
of
sorts, isn't it?
I mean,
we can sort of argue that, but I think, given their history and record of natural disasters, which goes back many, many centuries, there should have been more thought given to this before going ahead with them. They've crashed even in countries where there haven't been earthquakes, like Chernobyl and Three Mile Island, as we know, and there have been close calls in Windscale.
You obviously don't buy into the George Monbiot argument that is, you know, coal is disastrous and fatal wherever it's mined and used. Nuclear energy is only disastrous once in a blue moon and kills fewer people.
Well, what happened at Chernobyl was worse than any mining disaster or effects of mining that I know.
Well, I think he's talking about global warming, actually.
Yeah, well, I don't agree.
Which brings the death toll up a bit.
Yeah, I don't agree with him on this. I think other ways of energy have to be found, and especially in this part of the world where you have so much sunshine, I think the sun has to be harnessed. A lot of research and money is being spent on that, and I think that is one of the ways forward. There have to be alternatives found to nuclear power.
Meanwhile, back in the Middle East, what's happening in Bahrain? Saudi Arabia's put the lid on, hasn't it?
It has. And I think that it is, what is visible in the Middle East today, that the United States, having been caught on the back foot by these uprisings, is now engaging in selective vigilantism by threatening Gaddafi, but not doing anything about the Saudi regime, which in my view is even more pernicious than Gaddafi, more despotic, more dictatorial, which virtually regards half its population, women, as subhuman, which keeps the bulk of its population under very strict control. And I wrote at The Guardian once the Bahrain uprising began, I said the importance of this uprising is that it will threaten the Saudis. They will feel that if Bahrain can go, they themselves can be damaged, and that is the importance of it, apart from, of course, the desire of the Bahrainis themselves to be free. And that has now happened. There have been a few demonstrations in Saudi Arabia, which have been dealt with brutally, and the Saudis have now sent in troops, paid troops, mercenary troops, to go and sort out the Bahraini people and shore up this corrupt family, the Al Khalifas, which have ruled that island. And I don't think it's going to work, because I think an overwhelming majority of Bahrainis, Shia or Sunni, are against this regime. I mean, one of the chants in Pearl Square was, neither Shia nor Sunni, we are Bahrainis, we are Bahrainis. And I think that is the mood of the population. They just want to get rid of this wretched regime.
They don't just want to get rid of the wretched regime because it's a Sunni minority.
No.
And the majority of the population in Bahrain is Shia.
Well, that's not the main reason.
Because that's the trouble, isn't it? That one fears that it will come down to some kind of sectarian battle.
Well, that is the way the media likes to present everything. But I don't think that it is the case in Bahrain. There are Sunni groups, if we want to call them such, who are active and who have been actively engaged in this particular struggle. And I think the fact that it is a naval base of the U.S. fleet in the region is not unimportant. And one notices that the American response to what the Saudis have done in Bahrain is very formal. It's very, very limited. And it's not going to work out. I mean, I think the movement in the Arab world has now taken on a momentum of its own.
How did that happen, do you think?
I think it happened that, there are times when people in countries like the Arab states just feel enough is enough. And it was triggered off, if you remember, Kim, by an innocent young stallholder in Tunis at times of rising unemployment due to the economic crisis, saying to the police, I can't pay you a bribe to set up my stall in the market. I don't have any money. And the police dismantling his stall and the man setting himself on fire in despair. Now, this has happened before in other parts of the Arab world. On this occasion, it triggered off an uprising in Tunisia. People said enough is enough, because what they see is a large bulk of the population suffering and a greedy, venal elite, blind to the suffering of its own people, living as if there were no tomorrows and living cocooned in a bubble protected by Western states. I mean, this guy Ben Ali in Tunisia, the day before he had to flee to Saudi Arabia, was being offered aid by Sarkozy and Marie Alliot, his defense minister, saying, don't panic, we're about to come and help you, which is why I'd never take Western views, you know, sort of accept claims that the West is really defending fundamental human rights in these regions. It is not. The regime in Tunisia fell despite the French attempts to sustain it. And once the Tunisians had toppled their dictator, a victory, Egyptians who had been suffering now for 30 years under the Mubarak dictatorship, moth-eaten though it was, backed by the West, given billions of dollars each year because it did the West's bidding, especially in regard to Israel, the people of Egypt said, the Tunisians can do it, we can do it too. You know, the Tunisians are the most gentle people in the Arab world, and we are Egyptians. And the numbers of people who came out onto the streets after Ben Ali fled, I just felt at the time this is the end for Mubarak. Even though the West tried to save him, Hillary Clinton said he was like family. Your own prime minister defended him. Numerous other Western states said, no, we can't let Mubarak fall. But the people made sure that Mubarak fell. And at the end, he had to be dragged away protesting and screaming.
It is yet to be decided what will come after Mubarak, though.
No, this is true. And I think
a certain amount of caution is in order here, because there is a strong feeling, and you obviously don't share it, the better the devil you know.
Well, I mean, you know, then stick with Gaddafi. What are you threatening him for? Because he's the devil you were collaborating with, both CIA and...
Well, a lot of people tried to stick to Gaddafi until it became obvious that gunning down your own people wasn't a good look.
Well, Mubarak had been gunning down his own people too, not so dramatically. The dictator in Sana'a in the Yemen killed 39 people, his own citizens, by military snipers yesterday. The Saudis killed their own people. These countries have been used for renditioning to torture people picked up in Western countries. So I don't regard Gaddafi as any better or any worse than these other people who the West has been backing. So I think you're right about Egypt, that we have at the moment the military, a military council running the country, but the mass activity still goes on. And I think that they will not tolerate any prolonging of the military dictatorship. There are huge discussions going on in every single part of Egypt as to the future. So it's not over as yet. One important battle has been won, but they are continuing.
How do you feel coming from your, you know, particular revolutionary socialist background about the apparent lack of leadership in all these countries in terms of the uprising and the protests and the demonstrations? Well, who's in charge here?
Well, who's in charge here are groups of citizens, some politicians, political parties, but not of the left. No, the left is virtually absent in the Middle East. It suffered huge defeats after the Six-Day War in 1967. And then the Ba'athist regimes in Syria and Iraq helped, especially Saddam Hussein in Iraq, wiped out the bulk of the independent socialist communist intelligentsia in that particular country. So huge vacuums have been created, you know, as were created in Indonesia, the largest Muslim country in the world, after the military coup of 1965, when over a million communists and their supporters were literally exterminated. So when this sort of thing happens, you have a vacuum which lasts a long, long time. Following all that, you had the collapse of communism and the Soviet Union, which created a further vacuum. And I think people are taking time to recover. The South Americans have recovered and created new types of organizations, social movements, which have elected new leaders to power. And I'm constantly advising friends and colleagues in the Arab world that that is a feasible model for them to follow. And I think the Venezuelan constitution...
I was going to say, you'll be looking at Venezuela rather than Chile.
Absolutely, yeah. And the Venezuelan constitution is probably the most democratic in the world, which offers people the right to recall a president or a elected leader when they feel that his or her time has run out. And it's a good model for the Arab states to adopt, and I know it's being discussed quite seriously.
So once again, you feel that Hugo Chavez has been the victim of media personality destruction?
Well, of course, because he's not a
he's
friend.
He's been portrayed as a lefty buffoon, essentially.
Well, buffoon may be here, but in the West is quite a dangerous figure because he attacked neoliberalism long before the Wall Street crash of 2008, said they were going to dismantle it, and did in Venezuela. And effectively, he's been elected on 5 different occasions after 12 years in office. His opinion poll rating is 50% and over, and he has created in Venezuela what we in the old days we would call a radical social democratic government, which has pushed through many reforms that benefit the poor. And that is regarded in the neoliberal world in which we live as a crime. And that is the reason that he has been attacked, assaulted, vilified. They've attempted to get rid of him via military coups, etc., and failed.
I'm talking to political activist, historian, writer Tariq Ali, who's in New Zealand at the moment, to deliver the Sir Douglas Robb Lectures at the University of Auckland. Meanwhile, capitalism is alive and well. You know, did you ever really think that it would be superseded at any point in your career?
Well, I'm shocked say that capitalism
is alive.
It's alive, but not well, Kim. Not well at all. the countries you were modelling yourself on here, Ireland, had to be bailed out by the German banks. Massive unemployment.
But the thing was, it was bailed out. And nobody's saying, uh-oh, we got it wrong. Let's go to the other sea now.
Well, you know, lots of people are beginning to discuss these things now. Maybe not here, because what's preserved you and the Aussies and protected you and shielded you from the crisis is China. But in Western Europe, the situation is getting dire. I mean, Iceland collapsed, Ireland collapsed, Greece collapsed. Portugal is on the edge. Spain is on the edge. Britain is pushing through austerity measures that have now been contested by students, and the trade unions have called for a huge march later this month. So there is movement and activity out there, and people are saying that the neoliberal version of capitalism, worshipped for the last 20 years in the most dogmatic, fundamentalist way possible, is no longer on. And people are discussing alternatives nonstop. The elites in power and their followers in the global media networks, of course, like to pretend that nothing much has changed. But a lot has changed since the Wall Street crash. I mean, you even had a huge mobilization in the United States in Madison, Wisconsin, against the local governor and Republicans' attempt to totally destroy trade unionism and the right to collectively bargain by public sector workers. So there is now change, and then the events in the Arab world are making many people think in parts of Europe. I mean, I don't know whether this has been reported here, but there's been a huge movement building up in Croatia, where the government is totally corrupt and in the grip of criminal mafias. And for the last 2 weeks, there have been huge Arab-style demonstrations in the streets of Zagreb, in which parties of the right, of the left, of citizens from every walk of life have joined in, and their numbers are growing in size each day. So one can't assume that all is well.
Your argument, going back to the Middle East and Libya, is that the Iraqi people would have removed Saddam Hussein in due course, and the war was senseless and, of course, disingenuous in your book. How long would it have taken them to remove Saddam Hussein?
Well, you know, I don't know. How can one sort of predict this with any certainty?
He was pretty strong there. You know, there wasn't any sign of him being shifted.
Well, there was no sign of the Egyptians being able to shift Mubarak. What's there? The whole world was taken by surprise. In any event, I am not in favour of vigilantism by the West and NATO to go and remove regimes that they don't like.
So at what point does the West intervene morally and ethically?
Morally, the West has no right to intervene
anywhere at any time.
Its hands are bloody. In Iraq, over 1 million people have died. There are 5 million orphans. There are 2 million widows. The country has been wrecked. And people walk on the streets in the Western world as if nothing's happened. If any other person did it, they would be charged with war crimes. But because it's the West, no one can charge them with war crimes.
So if Gaddafi,
Cheney gets off scot-free.
So if Muammar Gaddafi continues to mow down his people, we should just watch and wait?
I think it is always best for people in that country to do it themselves. They can be helped.
How?
Regimes can be sanctioned. How? Are you going to apply the same criteria to the Saudi monarchy? They mow down their people. To the dictator in Yemen? He mows down his people.
Isn't that like saying, you know, it's all very well being good to your budgerigar, but you're not attending to the starving children. Do you know what I mean? You can't do everything, but selective's all right, surely. One can't do everything.
No, one only does things when it doesn't cost one anything, and it's an easy target. This is what I mean by selective vigilantism, which is currently, seems to be have become the rage again. I've noticed that even the UN Security Council forbids any ground troops, and for good reason. Because the memory of Iraq is still strong and the country remains occupied.
But let's go back to Rwanda, Tariq. You know, the world is constantly shamed by what it failed to do in Rwanda to stop that genocide. Are you suggesting that that was okay?
I'm not suggesting that that was okay. I think it is always better in cases of extremists for neighboring countries to be encouraged to act and not old Western colonial powers. You do not understand the feeling against these powers, and these attacks on Gaddafi will actually strengthen him. I'm convinced of that if they get serious.
Because Gaddafi can portray himself as a victim of the West.
Exactly. And so I think it is always better to find regional solutions. Rwanda was a disgrace. But let's look at the case of Idi Amin. Another dictator brought to power in Uganda by British intelligence, like Gaddafi in Libya, to get rid of Obote in the case of Uganda, who went totally out of control. And finally, it's the Tanzanians who went and got rid of him. Or look at Pol Pot in Cambodia, in this part of the world, backed by the West, backed by China, finally removed by the Vietnamese. But the United States and their allies refused to remove Pol Pot's representatives from the UN for 12 years that followed. That is what I mean by selective vigilantism. Much better that it was done by the Vietnamese. They removed him and they left. The Tanzanians removed Idi Amin and they left. They didn't stay on and build bases there. So it's much, much more effective when that happens.
Syria is interesting. Syria, people have always said, very similar to Saudi Arabia, I suppose, people have said, no, nothing will ever happen there. It's in lockdown mode. And there are, apparently, some demonstrations happening. No big deal, except that the last time an anti-regime protest took place in Syria was 31 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is going to happen there?
Well, my own feeling, reading of Syria, is that there, you know, obviously people want change. There's absolutely no question about that. But the regime is more popular than its counterparts because it is seen both in its own country and in neighboring countries as one of the only regimes which has, in recent years, managed to help the Palestinians, an issue, by the way, that we haven't discussed, which is a running sore in that region, Israel-Palestine, and has prevented the Israelis from having it all their own way in the region by backing Hezbollah in Lebanon. So that gives it a certain popularity and legitimacy which the other regimes lack. Having said that, however, I think that the demand which is growing in the rest of the Arab world will one day come to Syria. How soon, I don't know. A lot will depend on what happens in Egypt. So the new structures that emerge in Egypt, if a new form of democracy or social democracy exists and is institutionalized in Egypt, I think every single domino will fall.
Just as a matter of interest, I was skipping through there, and I do want to talk about Palestine-Israel conflict. Saudi Arabia has said that demonstrations in Saudi Arabia are both illegal, well, okay, and un-Islamic. How does that work, un-Islamic?
It's absolute nonsense, and it doesn't work. I mean, this is, you know, I read that too, and it made me laugh. It's utterly and completely ludicrous, and no one will take it seriously. In any case, the Saudi interpretation of Islam is contested by the bulk of the Islamic world. The Wahhabis, who have been in power in Saudi Arabia since the British first put this ruling family in, and the Americans then took over after the second and during the Second World War, their particular sect of Islam, Wahhabism, is very similar to, you know, biblical literalists and Quranic literalists, though in this case they are beyond literalism, because there's absolutely nothing in the Quran or even the traditions of Islam which says that it is wrong to rebel. On the contrary.
I was just thinking, the really interesting thing about the world is, at what point does self-interest become an act against somebody else's interest? I suppose that's just banal comment. But I was flipping through to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in your book, the United States should just, what, back off, stop giving Israel any money, stop defending Israel, stop defending Israel's right to exist?
Not stop defending Israel's right to exist, Kim, because no one can stop that. Israel is a nuclear power. Israel has the sixth largest army in the world. The Germans have supplied it with submarines. The Israelis have armed these submarines with nuclear weapons, and they patrol the Arab seas nonstop. So the notion that anyone now in the region or elsewhere can threaten Israel's right to exist is nonsensical. However, the question which is important is, what about the Palestinians? What about their right to exist as an entity? I mean, they had nothing to do with the Judeo-side of the Second World War that wiped out large sections of European Jews, the Third Reich. Why should the Arabs be blamed for that? I mean, the Palestinians, in my opinion, have become the indirect victims of that Judeo-side, that the Israeli regimes think that because the Jewish people suffered and were brutalized and massacred during the Second World War, that they can do what they like in relation to other peoples. And that's unacceptable. And for a long time, people thought you could have two states. Well, that two-state solution is now dead in the water. Two states will never exist. There is no Palestinian authority in the region. The authority you have is that of the Israeli Defense Force, and I think the Israeli regime, successive Israeli regimes, have now made a one-state solution the only viable solution in the long run. I'm not saying it's going to happen overnight, but I don't see any other solution in the region, and Western countries that back Israel should actually be putting pressure on it to do so.
Why do you think this two-state solution is so dead?
Because there aren't any two states, because the amount of settlements that have been built on occupied Palestinian lands are never going to be removed, because all that is being offered by the Israelis is disembodied little protectorates or Bantustans, and because the Palestinian leadership, the PLO, is totally capitulated, does everything the Israeli regime wants it to, because the democratic decision of the Palestinians to elect a different government was ignored by the West. So I think a two-state solution is now only on paper. It cannot exist on the ground, and everyone is aware of that. Now, the Israelis say we don't want to be attacked violently. Fair enough, but nor do the Palestinians. The siege of Gaza, the assault on Gaza, the war on Lebanon, again backed by the West. We can't finish Hezbollah off in 1 week. Have another week. We need a few more days to destroy Hamas in Gaza. Have another few more days. We are bombing peace convoys which want to break the siege of Gaza. That's a provocation. The West has totally failed to control Israel in any way. And successive American governments from Clinton onwards have essentially, basically done Israeli bidding. And this has now reached a crisis point in the Middle East. And then you have a situation where the Israelis have been arguing for years, look at us. We are the only enlightened state in the heart of darkness that is the Arab world. And when the Arab world rises to get rid of that darkness, the Israelis protest and defend Mubarak to the hilt. But I think the situation in the Middle East is changing, and it's in actually the long-term interests of Israel itself,
long-term
as many,
interest.
Many Jewish people realize.
But how long-term? I mean, if you were in Israel, if you were an Israeli, how would you feel now?
Well, many of my Israeli friends, and I have many, are celebrating what's going on in the Arab world because they know that it weakens their own government, which they regard as oppressive and which they criticize very, very strongly, unlike their colleagues in the West. I mean, I have often said to American and European journals, why don't you at least just print columns from Haaretz, which is a very distinguished Israeli newspaper? Don't allow your own correspondents to say, just reprint Israeli columnists who are covering Gaza, who are covering what's going on in Israel, and show the world what some brave, courageous Israelis are doing.
Your latest book, I think it's your latest book, The Obama Syndrome, Surrender at Home, War Abroad, argues that President Obama represents the status quo in politics. He's a continuation of George Bush. Sympathizers, of course, say he's a good man in a bad world and he can't change everything all at once. Why don't you give that view any time at all?
Because it's utterly irrelevant to me. I mean, whether Obama is personally a good guy or not, I mean, you know, that doesn't interest me. What interests me is not what politicians say, but what they do. That is the only criteria on which we should judge politicians from any political tendency or viewpoint. And I think Obama has failed on every count.
But failed for his own fault or failed because the system in the United States is bigger than any presidential wish?
Well, why didn't people say that about Bush? You know, I mean, the system is bigger. Bush has to do what the system
needs. Well,
maybe
the system is Republican, essentially. The system is conservative.
I'm afraid this was not always the case. It has become so because in the United States, like everywhere else, the Democrats have, you know, shifted sharply to the right, as social Democrats did all over the world, including in this country, where they pioneered neoliberalism. It was a Labour government in this country which actually began the large-scale privatization schemes, which ended in disaster for them. And very similar things have been going on in the States, that since the Washington Consensus was established in the 90s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there has been only one method permitted economically to run the capitalist system, and people from parties to the left of the traditional parties have caved into that. So the fact that they have done it, of course, is they have a perfect right to do it. But you feel in many countries now that it doesn't matter which party wins because we're essentially living under the dictatorship of capital.
Did you not share at all in the, let's face it, euphoria of the election of President Obama?
I was in the States a lot that year. The United States is a country I visit the most and speak in the most. And I was there during that year, and it was difficult not to be infected by the large-scale enthusiasm shown for him by young people who till then had been completely alienated from politics. And often, you know, I would attend meetings where young people were very enthusiastic for him. And they would ask me what I thought, and I have to confess, I often bit my lip because I didn't want to disillusion and demoralize them at that particular point in time. I said they will learn their own way, what these people are like, and they learned it very quickly. Many of them didn't bother voting for him in the midterms. And the other thing, Kim, is that if you look, you know, not just at my writing, which is very critical, but if you look at what has been published about him in the New York Review of Books by people who considered themselves his staunch supporters, people like Gary Wills, venerable liberal democratic historian, very, very sharply critical of Obama, so much so that even I was a bit taken aback at the speed with which the honeymoon came to an end, because the hopes that had been raised by the campaigning and the vacuous slogans, yes, we can, which sounds good but means nothing, had led them to believe that at least on some things he would be a bit different. And now they're realizing it's continuity all the way.
I'm just wondering how the 60s would have been had the internet, had social media been around. What do you think?
Oh, it would have been wonderful.
It would have been.
Without any doubt. I mean, I often think about that.
Do you?
You know, it would have helped communications. It would have, you know, sort of transformed personal lives. I mean, everything.
Mind you, I suppose the Bolsheviks might think the same thing were they alive.
Well, they could. But the Bolsheviks, interestingly enough, were very aware of the cinema as a medium, you know.
Yeah.
Quite interesting. A lot of writings on how important the cinema was, how it should be used, how it shouldn't be used. And of course, you know, every generation finds its own way of communications. I mean, you know, you can go to the 1848 upheavals in Europe. They spread by word of mouth, and messages arrived by courier saying, this is what's happening in Budapest, what's happening in Paris, you know, what's happening in Frankfurt. So people find different generations at different times find their own ways of communicating. And look, when the Mubarak regime persuaded the crony to whom they had given the Vodafone franchise to stop text messaging for 3 days or for a week, I can't remember now, it had no effect at all. People found other ways of communicating and mobilizing.
Mm. You know, I need to put this to you. You have always blamed America for the world's woes. I think that's true. America and its satraps and its vassals, as you put it. And as the conservative magazine Standpoint said of you, and you fielded this criticism before, it's the comfort blanket of 20th century leftism and will continue to be the comfort blanket of 21st century leftism, won't it?
Well, you know, what Standpoint magazine, which is a magazine of the extreme right, says about me does not interest me in the slightest, Kim. But
well,
since you've asked the question,
since
you've asked the question on their behalf, I will reply that I always thought it was a mistake when the Soviet Union collapsed and that whole world system went out of being and China went capitalist, for people to have imagined that that automatically meant that American imperialism had also come to an end. On the contrary, it had become stronger. And what I argued in Clash of Fundamentalisms was that we are now in a situation in world history which has no precedent, which is a single imperial power dominates the world as no other power has done before, and this is a fact that has got to be recognized. How you react to it is entirely up to you. But to imagine that because one system ended, the other had ended as well, has turned out to be a total and complete farce.
It's
and no one doubts it now.
I know, you know, the old reply to has the French, what happened after the French Revolution is too soon to tell. But do you think, we've only got 30 seconds left, do you think this year is a game changer in the phrase that has become adopted all over the place of late?
Well, I think that we are now witnessing changes in the world in the early years of this century, which are very promising, that the masses have re-entered the political stage in a very big way in South America and the Arab world. Asia, the bulk of the Asian continent is still quiet, but I don't think it will remain that way for too long. And Europe, I think, is on the verge of something different over the next decade.